This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Greetings. Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? And tonight we're going to be talking with Keith McCloskey. And let's get right into that. Keith, you there?
Yep, I'm here, Soraya. Nice to talk to you again.
And you were up very early in the morning for us.
Yep.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests.
Pitch black outside still.
And where are you?
I'm just west of London in a little town called Hungerford.
Hmm. All right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And this book, The Lighthouse, is this your second book or?
Well, no, it's my fifth book, but it's my second book on mysteries, if you like.
Right. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
What were the other three about?
Well, aviation history, but I don't think that'll appeal to your listeners too much.
All right.
It's a passion of mine as well.
Okay. All right. We had you on for your book on the Dyatlov Pass back about a year and some months ago.
Yep.
And that's been a very hotly debated interview. As some people are absolutely sure they know what happened. And maybe we'll get to a little of that later on.
Sure, yep.
And this book, however, the mystery, I don't know how to say it. I might know how to say this, but I'm going to let you give us the subtitle.
Yeah, it is The Mystery of the Elon Moore Lighthouse Keepers.
I would have had it close.
Yeah, Elon Moore is how it's pronounced in Scotland.
Okay, and this is, when did this come out, beginning of the year?
Well, a bit before that. It's been out getting on for, it's about 9 months now.
Okay, all right. Yeah. And this is about three lighthouse keepers who went missing at the end of 1900.
That's correct.
And this little island they went missing from is as remote as you can get, really, isn't it?
It's probably the most remote part of the British Isles. It's there's an outer ring of islands up in the northwest of Scotland, the Outer Hebrides, and it's actually 20 miles beyond that out into the North Atlantic. The next stop is Newfoundland.
Wow. Okay. And it's not a very big place.
No, it's a small group of seven islands, and they're very difficult to get to, mainly because the weather's nearly always bad there and there's no beaches. It's all steep cliffs, all of them, including the largest island, which is Elon Moore. And it's about, it's probably a few hundred yards long by a few hundred yards wide. It's pretty small, but it rises nearly 300 feet out of the sea.
And have people lived there prior to this lighthouse being there?
No, the only habitation, if you like, of the main island was in the 7th century when there was an Irish monk had built a small chapel there, which it still stands today. Actually, it's a small chapel built of stones, but it's tiny. And he, this Saint Flan, used to go on religious retreats there. It's an island that's really steeped in a lot of mysticism in pre-Christian times, which we'll come on to in one of the theories.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So now, I think it's important to set the tone here as to what life was like then, because it's only 115 years ago, but it might as well be a completely different world.
Absolutely. Apart from anything else, the when the lighthouse was built in the couple of years leading up to 1900, when the three men disappeared, it had only been in operation for a year, but they'd still been finishing off the building work right up to the October of the year that they disappeared. They disappeared in December. But it's lighthouses there in Scotland. They're no longer occupied by lighthouse keepers. There's no habitation on that island or any of the other lighthouses. But this one was automated in 1971. But it's as different a life as you can imagine from a work point of view.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, even technology-wise, there's... I mean, that was a world where there weren't cell phones, there weren't airplanes, there weren't, you know, these instant communication around the world. When these guys were isolated, they were more isolated. You compare it to being like in space, but even with astronauts in space, we have instant communication with them. These people had communication with nobody.
Absolutely. Well, that's the thing about it, is that once they were out there and once the ship left, there was no communication at all. The islands, as I say, were 20 miles away from the coast, so you could barely see them. Literally, they might as well have been on the moon without any communication. Once they were believed to have disappeared on the 15th of December, and it wasn't until the relief vessel went back on the 26th of December, 11 days later, that anybody found out they were missing. So they've been gone for 11 days.
And there were three of them, and that was pretty standard at the time.
Yes, it was, yeah. Most of the larger lighthouses had three men. They would take it in turns in shifts to keep the light working, and the other ones would get their sleep and rest, and then they could take over, so that there was a continual, so somebody would always be available. Obviously, the light was turned on in at night time, but there was work to do during the day as well. But somebody would always be resting and or sleeping whilst the others were working. So it was a fairly continual rotation.
And it seems tedious, especially by today's standards, I think.
Well, I've had a lot of help from former lighthouse keepers in Scotland with this book. One in particular gave me a great deal of help and explained to me what the life of a lighthouseman was like. I've also had help from, there's only two keepers left alive of people who had worked on Eland Moor. And I've been in touch with both of them, and one of them gave me pictures for my book that he took when he was working on there. And the other one also, as I say, he gave me a lot of help about what the daily life was like. But it was, you had to be a special type of character to be able to lead that kind of life, because you were three men cooped up together day in, day out. You couldn't go home. There was no home to go to. That was your home. So you had to knuckle down and try and get on with the other two. And that wasn't easy at times, apparently.
And the lighthouse was such an important thing at that time.
This particular lighthouse was built by the Stevenson family. They built a lot of the lighthouses in Scotland, you know, you probably heard of Robert Louis Stevenson, the novelist. He's from that family. But this was a prestige project, and there was a lot of publicity, if you like, was given to it when it was opened. And the superintendent of the Northern Lighthouse Board, it was his, if you like, his particular pet project. And he handpicked the men to work there, and it was a devastating blow to him when they disappeared. He was the last man to see them, three of them alive. He'd just been out there with his wife 10 days before they disappeared. And it was a major incident at the time. It was a big shock when the three of them disappeared. All the more because nobody really knows what happened to them.
Right, right. And but what I was also saying, like the idea of the lighthouse is so much more important then than it is now. Not that they're necessarily not important now, but with the computer technology and stuff, we have a pretty good idea where we are even without lighthouses. Whereas back then, they were very important in darker areas or when the weather wasn't so great to be able to figure out how close they were and where they were.
Yeah, it was absolutely critical, especially Elan Moor, because I call it Elan Moor because that's the main island, but it's commonly referred to, the group of islands, as the Flannan Isles, the Flannan Islands, after that the Irish monk Saint Flann. But they're more commonly referred to as the Flannan Islands. But there had been no lighthouse there, and they're quite dangerous rocks. I mean, they're really rocky outcrops sticking out of the water, and quite dangerous to shipping. So it needed something to warn shipping of the approaching rocks when they were in the vicinity. So, you know, it was a prime candidate, if you like, to have a lighthouse built on it. But in those days, it was, as I say, very important to, you know, you didn't have satellite and you didn't have radar then. Right. So they relied heavily on these lighthouses. And that particular lighthouse, the first person, if you like, or the first people to be aware that there was no light working was a ship that was sailing from Philadelphia. It passed on the midnight of the 15th of December, going into the 16th of December. It came within 5 miles of the group of islands, and the captain couldn't see the light, and he found it very unusual. They couldn't make out the islands, but they weren't bothered about that, because within 5 miles, the light had a range of 20 miles, and when the people on watch just couldn't understand why they couldn't see it. So they resolved when they got back to, they were heading from Philadelphia to Leith, which is the port for Edinburgh, that they would report the fact that the light wasn't working. But, and again, I'll come to this in a minute about a possible curse. That ship hit a rock and almost sank before it even got to the port it was heading to. But this was about another less than 48 hours further on the other side of Scotland. And I'd also say, and I'll mention it again, that ship disappeared without trace 12 years later, outside, just off the coast of America.
Huh. All right. Wasn't there another lighthouse, too, that was supposed to watch for that light coming on?
No, there are other lighthouses in the vicinity. There was somebody was paid by the body that ran it, was called the NLB, the Northern Lighthouse Board. They paid a gamekeeper on the main island of Lewis, which was 20 miles away, to keep an eye out to make sure that there was no problems with the light. But the trouble is, because they're so far out and because of atmospheric conditions, he would go many days where he wouldn't see the light, but he would put it down to the fact that it was bad weather or the atmosphere wasn't right. So it was not unusual not to see the light for him. But he hadn't seen it since the 7th of December, and he was getting a bit worried. He'd asked his sons to join him on the headland that's nearest to the islands to keep a watch for the light. So there was concern starting to grow when they didn't see it.
And you do a good job in the book, in the first few chapters, of just kind of giving a feel for what life on a lighthouse was like. And you tell a lot of different, it seemed very personal, stories from some of these people. Where did you collect those from?
Well, from the men that that work there. When I was doing my research, I thought, well, you can't write a book like this without speaking to the men who were there. And the Lighthouse Board were very, very helpful. They put me in touch with several people. One of the men who I know, who, strange story, I've known him for quite a few years, but I had no idea that he used to be a lighthouse keeper. I'd always thought he'd worked in the aviation industry, but he'd left, and started working in the aviation industry. And I couldn't believe it when somebody else told me that he used to be a lighthouse keeper. He didn't work on that particular lighthouse, but he knew of it. And he always he was telling me that it was never a very popular posting either. People didn't really want to go out there.
Yeah, it's understandable. I mean, such a small little rocky outpost in the middle of nowhere.
I mean, well, it had a bad reputation as well, you know, after these men disappeared. There's been other, you know, there's been other happenings at lighthouses, not just in Scotland, but around the world, you know, where people have disappeared. But this was the first time that three men, the whole complement, if you like, of the station, the whole three of them had gone. There's been other occurrences. There was a murder, which I mentioned in my book, in a lighthouse in Wales, where there was two keepers, one murdered the other. And there's another one. Sorry, that was in Scotland as well, actually, not Wales. But there was another murder in a lighthouse in Australia. And, people would disappear or die in strange circumstances, if you like. So it's not unusual, but this was unusual because it was everybody had just gone and nobody knew how or why.
Yeah, and you definitely have some interesting stories in there when you're talking about the murders and stuff. Do you want to set the scene for what happened when they finally did come to the island with their relief?
Yeah, sure. People were getting worried on the mainland, on the main island, that they hadn't seen the light. And he was a gamekeeper, and he was on the verge of actually sending a telegram to the Northern Lighthouse Board to say that, you know, he hadn't seen the light for many days. But what happened was there was a relief ship going out with another keeper to relieve one of the men on the island, and that had been delayed by a couple of days because of very bad weather. It's a terrible place in the winter. It's just constant storms up there, and really bad storms as well. So the relief vessel came up to the main island. There was a station on the main island where the families of these men lived, and where the men would come ashore for their break, if you like. They picked the other the relief keeper up, and they made their way out. It's not a long journey. It just takes a few hours for these older vessels to get out there. And they went out, and when they got to the island, there used to be a flag would be raised to show that they were expecting it, and the keepers would be down on one of the two landings there, because, like I say, there was no beach. You just couldn't pitch up in your boat and climb out of your boat. You had to be winched on. They had harnesses to lift the men on, because the water's always very, very choppy there. They couldn't see anything. They fired a rocket. and this went on for probably a good 30 minutes to three quarters of an hour. So they decided to lower a boat and try and land somebody, even though there wasn't anybody to receive them. So it was actually the relief keeper that went ashore. He was the first man. So he went up the landing, and he got to the lighthouse and found that the door was closed, but it was unlocked. And he went in, and everything was literally as if somebody just tidied up. Nothing was out of place, nothing knocked over or anything untoward. The beds were all made, and he ran back down because it was quite obvious something had happened, and informed the men in the boat to come up, help him to have another look. And then they went back to the relief vessel, and the captain of the vessel put some men ashore to start the light, get the light working for that night. And he then sent a telegram back to the main head office to say there's a kind of terrible accident had happened, as all three men had disappeared. But the point about it is that there was no clue as to what had happened to them. Two of the men had their outdoor gear on, but the third one, his outdoor coat, was still on its hook in the lighthouse itself. One of the rules for three men on a lighthouse station is that one man must always stay inside. And obviously this third man, his gear was on the hook, so he was presumably in his shirt sleeves. So to all appearances, it looked as if two men had gone out, but the third had stayed inside.
Except there was no one there.
Yeah, precisely. Nobody there.
Now there are some stories of like a half-eaten meal and an overturned chair and such, but you've discovered that was more fiction.
Well, there's been a couple of there was a guy called Vincent Gaddis who had written a book, and he had larged the story up a bit about strange entries in the logbook, saying that. There was a terrible storm. The men were weeping and they were praying. But, that's fictional. The overturned chair, the uneaten meal, come from a poem that was written about the disaster in 1912 by Wilfred Wilson Gibson. He was a First World War poet, but just before the war, he'd written this poem. And that's where that comes from. When the superintendent arrived to make a thorough search of the island and launch his investigation into what had happened, he had made the point that all the pots and pans were clean and the men had actually had their midday meal, but there was nothing out of place at all, which to me in some ways is even more unusual. It's as if the men had just disappeared off the face of the earth and tidied up everything before they left.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking. It's creepier that everything's exactly the way it should be rather than some sign of distress.
Yeah, because in some ways I think, if you left an uneaten meal, knocked the chair over, that suggests that, that there'd been something that happened.
Right.
They rushed out and maybe were swept over the cliff. But the fact that there was nothing out of place at all, obviously they didn't rush anywhere or there didn't seem to be any kind of a rush, as nothing was, the door was closed and, everything seemed just what you'd call normal.
Now, the official log from the lighthouse no longer exists, correct?
Well, that is correct, but when I've talked to the lighthouse keepers about this, they say the logbook was a sacrosanct record, highly unusual that it would disappear. The logbook was there when the superintendent went to make his investigation, but we believe what happened is that he took it with him. He had to write up his report after his investigation, and he probably would have taken a blank logbook with him, left that there for that to continue at the station, and taken the logbook with him back to Edinburgh to write up his report. But where it's gone after that, nobody knows, because I've been to the archives in Edinburgh. It's not there. There's a lot of correspondence there about the disaster. And even records that the men themselves had written leading up to the disaster, but the logbook isn't there. It's very very strange that should disappear, though.
Yeah. And that would possibly answer some other questions. All we have to go on is the reports that were turned in that referenced the logbook there.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a little inkling of what was going on, because in those days, you didn't write the logbook up immediately. You wrote on a slate with a piece of chalk. And when Joseph Moore, who was the first man in there, went in, he looked at the slate and he noticed that that had been written up to about lunchtime. Just before lunchtime, it put the weather in, what was happening that morning was there was the weather was getting worse, and it was building up to just below storm force, and it was it had been written on the slate to be put into the logbook, so we know, but there was nothing apart from that. It just said there was blustery showers, gave an indication that the sea was building up, and that's so we know something of that morning had been written by them, but again, nothing untoward. It was just like, if you like, a weather report.
Right. Now, there are a handful of theories of what happened to these men. There's obviously no proof one way or the other, because we never found the bodies. And there's just not enough evidence to say for sure what happened, but there are some things that seem a little more likely than others. Do you want to go over some of these, maybe starting with the giant wave theory, since that seems to be the accepted one by the Lighthouse Board?
Yeah, one thing I will say, firstly, about the whole thing, Soraya, is that the police weren't involved in this, or anybody else for that matter. I mean, can you imagine something like that happening today?
Yeah.
Whether it's in the USA or in Europe or anywhere, that three men would just disappear and they would leave it to somebody within that organization to investigate it and produce a report.
Yeah.
Very, very strange. But what happened anyway, the man who made the report was called Robert Muirhead, and he was, if you like, he oversaw the daily operation of each lighthouse. This was his pet project. He'd handpicked the men, and he was the last to see them alive. So, if you like, he was asked to investigate the whole thing. He had an intimate knowledge of the workings of the station because he'd worked the previous summer with them to get it up and running. His conclusion at the end of it was that it was a giant wave had swept the men away. And one of the reasons why he put that conclusion even without looking at anything, you think three men, lighthouse, lots of big waves, obviously it's a wave. If you like, the layman would arrive at that conclusion without even seeing the place or anything. It's not quite as cut and dried in that. But the reason he based it on the giant wave was there was two landings there where you could get onto the island. The east landing and the west landing. When he got there, the west landing had been hit by an absolutely massive wave, and railings had been torn from the concrete, pulled out of the concrete. A life jacket had been ripped from the railings and taken away by the force of the wave. And a large box of ropes, which took two men to lift, was found broken, and all the ropes had been scattered all over the rocks. And the thing about that box of ropes is it was 90 feet above sea level. So for a wave to have got up to that would have had to have been bigger than that,
right?
Probably. So it would have been a wave of 100 plus feet. And he based it on that. Now, you would think, obviously, to see damage like that, because it must have been an absolutely massive wave to have hit, and any men standing there wouldn't have stood a chance. There was a crane there as well, and part of the theory is that they were down at the crane. But whether it was a rogue wave or whatever, one thing I've learned from all the lighthouse keepers that I've spoken to is when the weather's bad, which it obviously was that day, is you lock all the doors and you stay in. You don't go out.
Right.
But the fact that the two of them had their outdoor gear on implies that they were out, but the third man wasn't. But the one thing I've done on the investigating on this is I've looked at the records, the weather records, which nobody had really done. I went to the meteorological office and we had a look at the records for the islands there at that time, and we found an interesting thing because I was involved in a, if I can just digress here a little bit, I was involved in making a film about not a film but a documentary about this for the Discovery Channel.
Oh.
on their unexplained files. It's actually still showing, and we met a meteorologist at the university, the Highlands and Islands University up in Stornoway on the main island, and he did a computerized model of the weather using those old weather records, and the islands were hit by a really bad storm, almost hurricane force, centered directly over the islands, but it was 2 days after the men disappeared. So all that damage was caused after they disappeared.
Huh.
Yeah, which is makes you think about the whole theory again of a giant wave. There was a giant wave, but it wasn't when they were there. And after that near hurricane, there was another violent storm which caused a disaster further up in some islands, up in the Shetland Islands, where the number of men lost their lives in fishing boats. So there was much worse weather after they disappeared.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So that's obviously stuff you came across after you wrote the book.
Yeah. I found the weather records while I was doing the book, and that's in the book. But I was actually involved in the documentary for the Unexplained Files just before the book came out, and I added a little bit in about that fact that the worst of the weather was after they disappeared. But if anybody catches it, it's on their second series of the Unexplained Files. We went out to the island and filmed out there.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. What does that say?
I was just going to say, just going back to the giant wave. So it's not quite as clear cut as it seems. For everybody to say it's obviously a giant wave, that's contradicted by the weather reports. It was a bad weather that day, but nothing to have caused the damage that was caused. But even Muirhead in his report says he noticed the damage to that landing, but it may have happened in a storm afterwards. So he does admit that much.
Now, that doesn't explain to people, though, why the third guy was out there.
Well, there's another theory about that. There was a keeper who was based out there in the 1950s, Walter Alderbert. He would have been one of three, but he was obsessed with the story. And he was out there for 5 years, and he spent a lot of time thinking about it and taking photographs of some of the waves that would hit the island. And he came up with a theory that the two of the men had gone down to the West Landing, which is where all the damage was, attending to the crane. And one of them had got swept away, and the second one had run back up to the lighthouse to get the third one to say, "There's a man in the water, come and help me." And that would explain possibly why he would run out in his shirt sleeves. But I've been there, and you'd need to be pretty fit apart from anything else. If you were on the crane platform, which is 75 feet above sea level, it would take you a good long run because it's quite steep to get back up to the lighthouse, and it's a good couple of hundred yards, so you're not going to do it in 2 or 3 minutes. It would take you, I estimate, probably a good 15 minutes at least.
Wow.
To run back up there, and then another 15 to run back down, probably maybe a little shorter. But you're asked to believe, though, with Walter Alderbert's theory, that a big wave came along, took one of them away, and then another big wave came along and took the other two away. It's possible, but I say implausible.
And that would also imply that he would think that running up to the lighthouse was the better option than trying to rescue him himself, knowing that it was going to take him a half an hour to get there and back.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. Because, my impulse would be to get a rope and just do it yourself. You know, if he's in the water, if the weather's bad and all the rest of it, you're losing precious time. Apart from anything else, they were wearing sea boots and oilskins, quite heavy gear. They'd have had their coats on because it was the middle of winter. There's a good chance, I would have thought, you'd have been dragged straight to the bottom if you'd have gone in.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that too.
Yeah.
Huh, all right. And then you go on in the book too, you also illustrate the whole phenomena of freak waves and such that just arise out of nowhere. And the whole giant wave thing, which is different from a tsunami, significantly.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, the thing is, I'm not saying there aren't freak waves there. There are. There's some gigantic waves up there. One of the biggest waves ever recorded was by a ship that was only a few miles away from there. Well, I say a few miles, a bit more than that. But in the area, there was a 90-foot wave officially recorded out there. not that long ago. They're really big waves. And what when we were talking to this meteorologist when we were doing the Discovery Channel program, he was telling me that the way these waves build up is they start building up down near Portugal because the prevailing winds tend to be coming from the southwest. And the way a wave builds up, you call it the fetch. And what's happening is a wave is forming and it's building up and building up and building up. And there's nothing to block its path. So they're building up and then they're coming up and then they're hitting the northwest of Scotland. And they've been building up for the best part of 800 to 1,000 miles. So wow. by the time it gets to those islands, you've got really massive waves approaching. Not all the time, obviously, when the weather's bad, but you can see how you can get these huge waves building up, and it does get hit by them, and it's a very stormy place. It's bad weather nearly all the time out there. There's an expression, they say December is all about storms in the Flannans, and it's if you don't like bad weather, it's a god-awful place to be, so... Nobody's saying that there aren't giant waves there. There are, but you see, all the more reason lighthousemen, especially the principal lighthouse keeper there, James Duckett, he had 20 years experience, and when you talk to these lighthousemen, they're not straight out of school. They know what the weather's like, and you don't put yourself in harm's way. That's why they always say, if the weather's bad, you lock all the doors, you bolt everything down, and you stay inside.
Huh. All right. Now, one of the other theories that people throw around is that maybe there was foul play involved. And it would have had to been among those three because there was no one else on the island. No one else could get to the island without their assistance.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, that's something that was focused on in the documentary that was done on the Discovery Channel as well. One of the three men, when we looked into it... It turns out that one of the three men had a bit of a reputation as being what you'd call a hothead. Excuse me. There was two keepers, lighthouse keepers there, who were employed by the Northern Lighthouse Board itself. They were proper official lighthouse keepers. The third man, Donald MacArthur, was a relief lighthouse keeper. And although he was employed by the board, he lived on the main island, and his services were only called upon when he was needed in the event that there was sickness. And one of the normal complement of the three men had been taken ill, and he was actually ashore at the time. So he had been replaced by this third man, Donald MacArthur, but he had a reputation as... if you like hearsay, that he was a drinker, a bit of a hothead, and not a person to, how should we say, take a lot of nonsense lightly. And he'd been out there when we looked at the records, or when I looked at the records, he'd been out there for the best part of two whole months. And he had a croft, which he ran on the main island, like a little small holding with his family. And I suspect that he was probably getting fed up because you'd do a stint of 6 weeks out there, but he'd already been out there with only a very short break for the best part of 2 months, and he was well into December, still out there with no end in sight. And it could have been that he was getting really fed up with it. And one of the theory that I put forward in my book, or one of the theories, is that he had an altercation with the principal lighthouse keeper and attacked him. It could be, and the situation I put forward is that the two men went out with their weather gear. He'd said to MacArthur, James Duckett had said to Donald MacArthur, I want you to come down to the crane with me to have a look. MacArthur had said, given his temperament, well, you can do it, I'm not going. And so the third man, who was a bit of a gentle giant, he went instead. And we think that MacArthur may have been fuming over the exchange and that this had been building up for quite a period of time. And he went out after them and caught up with them by the steps, and possibly a fight broke out and the three of them went over. with the third man trying to intervene, because apparently he was a bit of a brawler, this bloke. Now, it could be that you might think, oh, well, the three of them going over, highly unlikely, but I've been out there, and the steps that go down to that landing and the crane, even a gust of wind would take you right over the edge to go straight down nearly 200 feet. It's a hell of a height, and there's nothing to stop you, and the steps are very, very steep, and if you lose your balance, you wouldn't be able to stop yourself going. They're quite dangerous.
Huh. All right.
But, yeah, so that's, if there was any theory where there'd been foul play, there was no sign of it in the actual lighthouse itself. So if something happened, it would have happened outside.
Right, right. And, of course, there's the supernatural element that a lot of people will lean towards, and there's a lot of history in those island chains of different things as well in the folklore sense.
Yeah, there is. I mean, you can't. I don't think you can necessarily dismiss those theories that easily, because there's a lot of bad luck associated with that place. Just before I get into that, in pre-Christian times, it's believed that bodies were taken out to that island and they were buried there and burnt on funeral pyres. There was a man named Martin Martin who chronicled the history of those islands up there. He had a book published in 1703. And what he found when he was talking to people up there is that the local people, and some say even to this day, they're very superstitious people. And it's considered that they were always considered to be almost holy islands, you know, the sanctified place, you know, with the burials of the dead out there. And, you know, the theory is that the sanctity, by building this lighthouse out there, the sanctity of the dead had been disturbed, and that's why the men disappeared with no explanation for it. I don't know if you remember, there was a film out, it was redone with Nicolas Cage, called The Wicker Man.
Yes.
That was set, that was the whole point of that film was, you know, an island where, you know, it was pagan festivals were reenacted, and in the original film, which was made in 1973, the policeman investigating it gets burnt alive at the end by the islanders. There's a lot of it based. Part of that film was based on the sort of happenings up there, you know, in pre-Christian times.
And I would recommend that if anyone's going to watch it, they watch the original, not the remake.
Yeah, the remake I didn't think was that good.
No.
But the original had a real spooky, I know it's an old film now, 1973, but it had quite a spooky sense about it.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
with the policeman trying to find out what's going on and everybody knowing something that they're not telling him. And you can almost sense the doom coming in the film. It was quite well done.
Yes.
But when they used to take sheep out there as well and graze them out there, and they used to, in Martin Martin's time, who wrote the history book, he spoke to people who would go shooting fowl out there. But when they went out to it, it was they had rituals. They would say prayers whilst moving round the stone chapel out there. They would say prayers where they would go around the chapel three times, and it was treated as a very holy place. They would approach once they got onto the island, they would approach the chapel on their knees. So there's a very mystical sense about it. And there's pre-Christian burial markers on the main island as well. I mean, to go up there, you get a real sense of it, you know. And it's felt that the sanctity of the dead had been disturbed, and that's why, without explanation, the three men just disappeared. But there's also, I'd like to go on to, a lot of bad luck associated with the place. I mean, obviously, you could say there's bad luck with three men disappearing, but you've got that ship that passed that night, the Arch Tor, that hit a rock before it even got to port after leaving the islands, within 48 hours, just before it reached port, it hit a rock and almost sank. That ship then sank with everybody on board without trace 12 years later. And one of the men working on the island died out there. There was one of the reliefs who came to replace one of the three missing men. He fell from the light tower and was killed within a very short space of time of arriving out there. And one of the man who was meant to have been there on the day the three men disappeared, Donald MacArthur had replaced him as a relief. He dropped dead on his next posting in the lighthouse. So, you know, there's a lot of, what's the word? You know, people could say, well, it's all just coincidence, which, of course, it could be. But there's also a lot of bad luck attached to it rather than good luck.
Now, what about the legends of little people on the islands?
Well, yeah, the little people, there's supposedly a race of pygmies that lived up there. Again, you're going back to when Christianity was coming into the islands. There was a race of small men living up there called Lost Burden. They were pygmies. They were, I gather, not particularly pleasant people. There's been various sites excavated where they found bones of, I mean, some of these bones have been examined and people are saying, well, this is, you know, or small animals or whatever, but nevertheless, there are stories about these pygmies, but one of the earliest Christian saints up there was hanged by them. So they weren't known to be very pleasant people. And again, it comes back to this sense of mysticness, if you like, and well, I wouldn't quite say spirituality in their case, but it's not a good thing, you know. The whole sense of the place seems to be don't disturb this place because bad things will happen to you. That's the overall feeling you get from it.
Okay, and there's also some theories that they had maybe ingested some ergo-contaminated bread as well.
Again, that's possible because when you get when in those days when they were relieved, you got your rations for, you know, the next 6 weeks basically, and it could be longer because with bad weather up there, you could be out there for 2 months, 3 months at a time. So whatever food you got had to last you because there was no running water out there, you know, that you could catch rainwater, obviously, but there was nowhere to grow food. Some, in later years, some of the lighthousemen were telling me that, you know, you could catch lobsters, and you could catch fish, but they basically had to rely on the food they got. And the bread they got, you know, if it was rye bread, if it was contaminated in any way, with ergot, then, you know, it could affect you quite badly. It would imply that all three of them would have had to have eaten it, but it makes you behave in very strange ways. So it's a theory, you know, and why not when you think in place of the fact that there's nothing else that's been proven. To me, it has as much validity as anything else. The three of them could have been hallucinating, just walked out, two of them put their stuff on, third one didn't and just walked over the cliff or were washed away, walked down towards where the waves were and just disappeared.
I would think the thing that argues against it is that two of them put their winter gear on to go outside, which says they were thinking somewhat rationally.
Hmm. Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, we can't prove anything, you know.
Yeah.
That's the thing with a lot of these mysteries, though, you know. I always keep an open mind on everything. You've got to. To be honest, in this particular case, I don't think it's ever going to be solved because it's 115 years ago now, and you know, it's not like the two people had seen the logbook, so there's nothing untoward in that. So everybody, obviously, who was alive then is dead now. There's nobody left alive. Say, unlike. Say the Dyatlov mystery, where there are still people alive who may know what happened, but right, in this case, there's absolutely nothing. So all you're left with is just conjecture, and you know, putting forward your own theories. There's nothing to back them up. I mean, you never know. So they say they searched the island thoroughly. maybe they might find three skeletons there, but you know, would they still be in any condition to be found? Because when I went out there, we landed on the West Landing, and it's quite dangerous to get up there, which shows you the power of the waves. In 115 years, it was automated in 1971. So in, 45 years, it's the waves have washed away the steps, which were built into the place. So we had to use ropes to get ourselves up. You put them into some metal spikes that were sticking out of the ground, out of the rocks, to get ourselves up there, and it's quite slippery. So but it shows you that the waves have, literally eaten all the concrete or smashed the concrete away. So even if there had been skeletons there of the men that you may have found, I'd imagine there's probably nothing left of them either.
Right. All right. Well, before we move on to some updates on the Yatloff Pass, the book is The Lighthouse. The mystery of the
Elon Moore Lighthouse Keepers.
All right. And you are, of course, Keith McCloskey.
Yep.
And this is out on History Books, isn't it?
History Press.
Okay.
Yep.
So your other book, which is on the same book company, is on the Dyatlov Pass incident, and that was entitled Mountain of the Dead.
Yep.
And you said there's been some new updates to some of that material.
Yeah, there was somebody went up to the pass recently. They took it's still in the process of being looked at. It's somebody with a bit of money, obviously, because they took a helicopter to get up there. But they took metal detectors with them, a party, and they've been scouring the whole area. I mean, there've been other people up there with metal detectors, but. They found the remains of a crashed military aircraft up there, which is interesting. But the initial findings are that it may be from a later period. But it's an interesting development. And there's been some new theories put forward. One I quite like, I have to say, and I'll give full credit where credit is due, a guy who I correspond with regularly, called Steve Smith from Chattanooga. I'll say hi, Steve, if he listens to this. He came out with an interesting theory that there was a lot of illegal mining going on in the Ural Mountains. I mean, there is mining in the Ural Mountains of gold, amongst other types of mining. But gold mining always attracts people for obvious reasons.
Right.
And his view is that there might have been illegal mining going on, and that that is something in Soviet times that would have been punishable by the death sentence, because it was an economic crime. So anybody who was prospecting for gold and shouldn't have been, who had been discovered, would probably take great pains to ensure that anybody who'd seen them wouldn't live to tell the tale. So I quite like that theory, and I've just tried to contact a Soviet expert, he's a Russian expert on Soviet times and mining, to give me his view on that. But it's quite an interesting development, because nobody's put that theory forward before. I'm hoping to get up there in August to go up with Yuri Kuntsevich from the Dyatlov Foundation. I'm hoping to interview some people up there, how shall we say, within the authorities, but it's difficult getting people to talk, but I'm hopeful on it, so we shall see what happens, and I'll keep you posted on it.
I would think that the one obstacle to almost every theory is the condition the bodies were found in, because if it was illegal mining, why not just dispose of them?
Absolutely, yeah. But you see, I suppose you could say the ground was hard. You know, you can't dig so easily. But my gold prospecting is done in water, so, you know, you'd have had to break ice to do that anyway. But you see, I must admit, I'm toying with the idea of a new book and going completely into my theory on it, which discounts a lot of the official versions. You know, this business of, you know, eyes missing. I mean, you can see there's eyes missing from the photographs, but the tongue missing and all the rest of it, makes me wonder whether the guy who performed the autopsies wasn't told what to do. You know, it's almost as if somebody said to him, look, when you do these autopsies, you make it look as if some of them had died of this, some of them had died of something else, so you'll never really get to the bottom of it. And that's why I included the bit about the anthrax in my book, because the authorities were, you know, basically would change any autopsy to suit the story they wanted. So, you know, I'm not even sure that you can go by and all the autopsies that were released. When you look at the radioactivity as well that was supposedly in the clothes of some of them, they didn't even specify. They talked in loose terms of jumpers and bloomers, etc., you know, that had traces of radioactivity. They didn't even specify this was on this body or this body that was found here. It was all done in a very general sort of sense. And the radioactivity was connected. They compared the samples, the tissue samples, with people who'd been involved in car accidents, you know, or in accident, died through an accident in the city itself, in Sverdlovsk. So to compare them, I can understand that, but everything seemed to be mixed up. It's almost as if people, you know, there was being done to fuzz the issue. You could never get your teeth into anything. You couldn't say, well, this is Luda's body. She had this amount of radiation in her body and all the rest of it. But, I mean, you could probably get to the bottom of that now, because radiation lasts for a long time, and you could probably exhume the bodies and carry out further tests. But apparently they won't allow that.
Huh. Okay.
So, you know, but like I say, I wanted to go into it and start pulling it apart. There's a guy I want to meet when I'm over there who gathers, not easy to talk to, but I'm may put out feelers to see if he'll see me while I'm there. He was the first guy to start pulling the whole thing apart. And I think that's what it needs. I think too many people look at it and take at face value what's been said. And it's only when you start to do that, you know, things start making a bit more sense. There's a good quote by, I don't know if anybody reads, and my Spanish is not particularly good, so excuse me for mispronouncing his name, but Jorge Luis Borges, the novelist. He said, I can't remember the actual saying, but he talks about mysteries, but he said, mysteries are sort of all fine and well, but he said, when you start digging, you'll find things, most things are sleight of hand or slate of hand, which I think it's a pretty good saying.
Yeah, well, there's definitely some genuine mysteries out there, but yeah, I mean, sometimes people want to mystify things that don't need to be mystified.
Well, let me give you another example, Soraya. It's in the book, and they discovered it just before the book went to press, and so I had to rewrite it very quickly, and I didn't do it. I don't think I did a great job on it. But, you know, there was a plane disappeared. It took off from, I think it was Severalsk Airport, with a local police chief on board. Basically, what had happened, they'd all had a lot to drink. There was a party of, I can't remember how many now, nearly a dozen people climbed into an old Antonov too. All pissed out of their heads, and I don't mean, sorry, you don't want swearing on here, but we use the expression pissed not to be angry. In
right, that's fine. Here.
But we mean very drunk. But they'd all had too much to drink, climbed on board the plane to continue the party, God knows where, in a clapped out old aircraft. The plane took off and it was never seen again. So there was all sorts of theories that this was, I actually had some of the papers sent to me that were printed in Russia at the time. You know, they brought up the Dyatlov theory. They said, this plane's disappeared. Is this anything to do with the mysterious orbs that took the Dyatlov people and all the rest?
Right.
And just before the book went to press, the plane crashed just a couple of miles away in a swamp. So the pilot was obviously too drunk to maintain control and went straight into the swamp. All the bodies were found. So, you know, a mystery is only a mystery till you get the answer, and the answer, sadly, is usually very mundane.
Yes, yes. Well, there are a lot of people who like to compare the Dyatlov Pass incident to the work David Paulides is doing. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
I am, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I think what he's finding counts as a mystery for the moment, at least, until we know what's going on. But there's not really a connection between what he's looking at and Dyatlov Pass, even though a lot of people want to, you know, make that connection. The criteria he uses are completely different. None of them are present in the Dyatlov Pass scenario.
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm familiar with his work. And the thing about Dyatlov is it is strange. There's no doubt about the Dyatlov story. It's very, very strange. You know, if it was just, say, one person, you know, you think, okay, or even two or three. But we're talking about nine people, all very fit and, you know, intelligent people. They weren't stupid. They knew what they were doing. They knew where they were going, and yet they all wind up dead in very, very strange circumstances. So even if there's a rational explanation, it still doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense. You know, it's
yeah.
And I want to say also, Sarai, that I do, despite what I've just said there, I keep a very open mind on Dyatlov. I think you've got to. I think if you say this is my theory and I'm not going to listen to any other theory, I think you're closing a lot of avenues for yourself to investigate it. You know, I know people have their pet theories. This guy who went up there and found the military aircraft, you know, the crash site, his theory is that it's a missile had killed them, you know, a missile blast, which, right. You know, and his view of that final picture where you see the lights coming down, you know, his view is that that's different stages of the missile breaking up. It's possible, but, you know, it's not backed up by the dates of launches. But it, to me, he's closing it all off. You know, he's explaining part of it, but he's not explaining all of it.
Right.
You know, and okay, the authorities may have cleared it up, but it could be as people say, it could be a combination of theories or whatever. But, you know, I don't close off anything. I mean, people have contacted me. If you look on my Dyatlov website, I was contacted by someone in California who's a medium, and they had a session using the photographs, and I put the details on my website from that medium. Now, a lot of people would throw their hands up in horror and say, "Oh, you know, fancy believing in this?" But I my mind is open. I don't necessarily go along with what was said or whatever. But you know, it's just another theory.
Right,
right. And by using another theory, somebody may arrive, you know, at a different route to the right answer, you know. And like I say, I say to everybody that I discuss it with, if you can think of any other angle on it, let me know, you know, and let's discuss it.
Right, right. And the thing is that what I liked about both your books and what I like about talking to you is that you're very grounded about it, but you're also an open-minded skeptic.
Well, yeah, that's probably, yeah, it's a good way to describe me, I think, because one thing I don't discount is the light odds. There may be something very unusual happened there. And I have to say, there's a part of me, you know, when I was a bit younger, you know, I'd say, oh, you know, don't talk to me about that rubbish or whatever. But there's a few things have happened to me in my life where I have become a lot more open-minded about possibilities. You know, the UFO theory. I know people will lump UFO theorists into a group and say, you know, give them a label, you know, a not very nice label or whatever. But, you know, it can't be disproved.
Right.
That's the whole point about it. And, you know, people have been slated for the Yuri Yakimov theory. I mean, I do believe he did see something, and something that was inexplicable, and it was backed up by a forest ranger with the strange lights. I believe him. I believe he saw something. What it was, none of us know. He doesn't know. The forest ranger doesn't know.
Right.
I mean, the forest ranger is a guy that said this in the other interview I had with you. You know, he's a guy who's lived in the forests all his life. You know, not easily scared, but, you know, whatever it was that happened frightened him.
Right, right. And the thing with UFOs, I mean, if you look at the lighthouse thing, they have the tales of little people being there. And people like Jacques Vallée have shown the connection between UFO encounters and little people encounters back in those days as well. So,
yeah.
Whereas I don't necessarily believe that's what happened to them. I mean, there could be a possible connection there. You never know.
Well, no, but the fact it's the, you see, the thing between the lighthouse and the Atlov is whatever happened, nobody has actually been able to give a rational explanation for any of them. You know, I know you can say a big wave, but to me, if you'll pardon the pun, it doesn't really wash because, you know, it's too simplistic in my view. And I know people say, well, the simplest answer, and I do say you can use the principle of Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is usually the right one, but I don't believe it is in this case, you know. And every lighthouse keeper I've spoken to has said to me they just wouldn't have been down on that west landing. They may have put their outdoor gear on to check something else that was happening outside the immediate area of the lighthouse station because the wind was very high. You know, there was loose equipment out there. That's more than likely why they were out there in their gear. But, you know, this theory that you would put yourself in harm's way, a man with 20 years' experience of, you know, being in dangerous conditions, just wouldn't have put himself in danger or his work co-workers. So, you know, I don't believe that the simple explanation is the right one. And you know, you can't explain it. You can't explain the Atlov. Nobody can. People can say, this is what happened. But my answer to that is, well, prove it beyond doubt. And nobody can.
Yeah, the Yeti explanation seems to be a favorite of a lot of people. And I think the problem starting right there is we don't even know if the Yeti exists, much less if it had anything to do with this incident.
Well, I think, you know, again, I don't say it's a load of rubbish because I was involved again with the Discovery Channel. They concentrated on the Yeti theory. You know, the thing is, all right, if there is a Yeti, it's obviously a very large, powerful, wild animal, similar to a bear.
Right.
So you would expect to see, I mean, the one thing about the Atlov is you can see pictures of the bodies, and I mean, none of them look as if they've been, you know, attacked by a wild. You'd expect bites, you know, limbs torn off, if you like. And presumably Yetis have to eat, so you'd expect, you'd expect, you know, that there'd be sort of signs of them having been eaten by a wild animal, but there was none of that. You can't see any of that in the photographs, and assuming the autopsy is genuine, then, you know, there was no mention of any bite marks. What I would say about the Yeti, and it only occurred to me the other day, is it seems to be a creature that, although nobody's ever really captured one or seen one, seems to me to be a creature that's similar to the bear. And I would have expected Yetis to probably hibernate because they're similar type of creature. So, you know, the bears hibernate. That's why they weren't attacked by a bear.
Right, right.
You know, so you don't expect to see these types of animals out anyway. And plus, you know, I think with Yetis, you would expect to see tracks, not just related to the Atlov, but you'd come across other tracks, you know, if they are around, there's going to be obviously more than one of them, and you would expect to see more tracks. I know it's pretty remote up in the northern Urals, but you know, it's not that remote. You know, there's a couple of two or three tour groups now leading people up there. There's a sort of scenic stones beyond where the Dyatlov passes. So there's people up there all the time. There's people going up there in winter now. You know, I mean, it's easier to get to these places with more, you know, you can use not just skiing, but snowmobiles.
Right, so
And people just don't come across these tracks or, you know, any other sightings of them.
Hmm. All right. Now, what are you working on next? Is this going to be more like the Atlov?
There's two. You know, I'd like to put my own view forward on the Atlov because I haven't really done that yet. But to do that, I need to speak to people. I need to speak to people in Russia. You know, interview them, you know, that's not going to be easy, but I've got several people I want to interview for a new book and go into the theory myself, do a bit more research on the military, what they were doing up there. But also there's a new book I want to write about the disappearance of two girls in Rome in 1983. I won't say too much about it, but there was two girls disappeared within 6 weeks of each other in the center of Rome. And there's all sorts of theories about it. They were linked to, if you can believe it, sex parties at the Vatican, Italian gangsters. But they're strange, very strange disappearances. And it's a big case. It was a big, both disappearances were quite big at the time. And I mean, and they still have a lot of interest in Italy. But I became quite intrigued by it. The fact the two girls just disappeared in broad daylight in the center of Rome. They've never been seen since.
Huh. All right.
So I'm hoping to make a start on that very shortly.
So would that likely be your next one then?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping to get over there fairly. Again, the thing is with anything like this, I think you've got to go there, see the place, you know, see where they disappeared, talk to their family if they'll talk to me and talk to people who are involved. So, you know, do properly research it. I don't believe in doing things sitting in your armchair. I like to go to the place. It's like just going back to the Flannans. You can't get an idea of what the place is like. I mean, there's been plenty of armchair theorists on it, but you've actually got to go there. If you go to my website, my author's website, not the Dyatlov one, which is www.keithmcloskey.com, if you go on to my Lighthouse book, if you scroll down, I've taken a number of pictures while I was out there, which shows you what it was like, you know, the spot where the men were believed to have disappeared from by the superintendent. I actually stood on that very spot. But you can't get a sense of what it's like till you actually go there, you know. And you get, we were coming back on the boat in the early evening, the sun was setting behind the islands, and you really get a sense of the loneliness of it. You know, you can't describe the feeling, and you can't do that by looking, you know, the pictures on the internet. You've got to go there and feel it, if you like.
Hmm. All right. Okay. And Dyatlov website is what?
It's Mountain of the Dead. If you like, I'll tell you what, sir. If you wouldn't mind, could I send you the links?
Yes, I will put the links in the archive entry with the interview.
Yeah, it's Mountain of the Dead is the .com www. I think there's a dash in the middle of it, but I'll send you the links if you'd be so kind as to
Absolutely. Put
it up. But all the new theories, and there's a few new theories coming through. I put them on the Dyatlov page. Again, if you just scroll down, you can see the theories. If anybody wants to contact me and like to discuss the theory, with their permission, I'll put it up on the website because it gets other people thinking. Another interesting one, which is on my website, which I'm not sure I discussed the last time, and I won't use any foul words here, but apparently the Mansi used to distill reindeer urine to drink because it gives you hallucinations. Mm. And there's one of the theories put forward is that they drunk some of that and made them behave the way that they did because they were in the Mansi area and they you know, they'd met Mansi tribesmen. So, you know, it's again, that's a possibility.
Yeah, yeah.
That's on the website as well.
I think that's a pretty decent possibility, too. I mean, because once they're in that altered state, who knows what they're capable of doing?
Well, the other thing I liked about that theory, Soraya, is that, you know, the old Soviet Union in the late 1950s, a pretty dry, dour place, you know, and any type of misbehavior was frowned upon by the authorities. So you got a bunch of young people want to let off a bit of steam. Maybe they, you know, they went up there and they're letting their hair down and somebody says, try some of this, you know, it'll make you feel really good. And they probably thought, why not? You know, it's quite plausible.
Yeah.
You know, a bit like going away and, you know, taking a couple of bottles of whiskey, having a party on the beach, you know, you let your hair down, you think, well, let's try something different. And you know, nobody's watching us, and we're out in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, it's quite plausible.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I thank you for talking with us tonight, or early morning your time.
Yep. Yeah, I'll get a couple of hours in still, I think.
All right. Well, I look forward to your next book. And,
I'll be in touch anyway, sir. I've got a bit of work to do, so you won't hear from me for a little while, but I'll stay in touch. Obviously, any developments on Dyatlov, I'll certainly keep you in the picture.
Awesome. Thank you very much. It's a fascinating story. And both books, again, I highly recommend. They're both well worth reading. The Lighthouse book, you do such a great job of putting you in the feel of what that time period was like and what it must have been like to live that life. It's and you definitely explore the whole thing in great detail in this book.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. This is Nightmares. Thank you, Keith.
Yeah, thank you, Soraya. All the best. Bye-bye.
Shut the closet door. It's under the floor. The monster's there. Don't leave me here among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire. You were so sure I grew up waiting.
Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me.
I don't want the unicorn. I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform.
Cause I'm a monster. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a song I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Rachel, he clot, a cause disaster. Home from sector to primavera. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Now ammunition, give me an Armageddon. Give me the daring to forfeit ordinary dreams for the cost of pleasing humans far too steep. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me.